You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother,
Hello, Caroline everyone. Newborn.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, how are you?
Well,
I'm busy.
Yeah, we're all busy. Got lots of family in town this week.
Big family reunion.
My son and your son and
grandchildren and
I don't have any of those yet, but my son and his
wife. You have grand dogs.
Grand dogs, yeah. We have the Rottweiler and the Boxer, and they just really like me. They're so happy to see me. Oh yeah. Yeah, they're so happy to see me when they come. All the way from Austin, Texas.
Okay, good deal.
Yeah. And of course Anthony and Debbie, his wife.
Yeah, right. They're gonna see you too.
Yeah. Well, what do we have today?
Well, we have a really interesting book to talk about, and an interesting author to talk with, Kathy Macias, and she is an award-winning writer who has authored or co-authored 15 books, including the popular Matthews and Matthews detective series from Brodmann and Holman, Obsession, The Price, and Ransom, and the best-selling women's devotional, A Moment a Day, from Regal Books. She has also edited, rewritten, or ghostwritten more than 100 other books. Wow. Published numerous articles, short stories, and poems in various periodicals, and served as a staff member for a major manuscript critique service. She started as a former newspaper columnist and string reporter. She has taught creative writing and business writing for nearly two decades in various venues across the country. And this book is fabulous because it's a workbook. And I really enjoyed it.
It's called The Train of Thought Writing Method.
Yeah.
Welcome, Kathy.
Well, thank you so much, Monica. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Should we start with the Train of Thought Method and sort of start
yeah,
there?
Yeah, let's start yeah. with that. The Train of Thought Method, the engine.
What exactly is the Train of Thought Method, Kathy?
Well, I wish I could tell you it was something original that I came up with, but it's not. It's something that's probably been around for quite a while under one name or another, and one of the more popular and simpler writing methods ever devised, although I've added a lot to it and tweaked it a bit. But it's basically the whole purpose is to teach us to stay on track with our writing, because I think if there's anything that new writers are most guilty of, it's getting off track and going off on tangents, mm-hmm. and actually not just new writers. we all do that to some extent. So the purpose of the Train of Thought Writing Method is to get us on track and keep us going in the right direction steadily and smoothly so that the readers have a good ride.
How did you first hear about this method?
Well, actually, it was way back when I wanted to be a writer prior to that, I went to my first Christian Writers Conference, I would say in the early 1980s, and a lady named Georgiana Walker, and anyone who's been to any Christian conferences way back then remembers that name, she was actually teaching that. And I was so impressed, because even though I had done some writing and even some journalism, I had not come across anything that seemed so clear to me. So I really took that home with me and began to apply it and found that it was every bit as workable as she said it was. So that was where I first came across it.
Okay, well, as you say, there are a lot of different ways out there, different theories, but this one I found most interesting because it is logical. I mean, that's, you know.
Exactly, yes. If you follow it simply from one step to the next, I can't guarantee you'll end up with something that will enable you to leave your day job and live in the Bahamas the rest of your life, but you will definitely have a publishable manuscript, and that's what's so exciting to me.
Yeah, you bet.
Why is it called a Train of Thought?
Well, simply because of the way it's laid out. The first step as you begin this entire process is to really figure out what the focus is, what your takeaway message is, and that's what we call the track. We begin by laying the track, and that's usually a one or two sentence formula that just pulls you back. In fact, I actually, when I come up with it, I type it out and I put it where I can see it while I'm working to keep me on track, and that is the main message of the entire piece, whether it's a short article or a book. And then it begins to lay it out, the entire work, according to the visual of a terrain with the engine that pulls the whole thing, with the separate box cars being the different ideas that are contained within the article, and hopefully in a logical progression, which is really important. The couplers that hold the cars together, because we all know if we get on a, jump on a train, and it doesn't matter what car we're sitting in, if it isn't hooked to the one in front of us, we're
not
going,
anywhere.
And one of the things I really object to with so much writing is that the writer may have great ideas, but the individual ideas within the piece aren't hooked together smoothly, and so they end up with a rough ride. You'll notice that when you're reading something, and it almost jars you from one thought to the next, as opposed to transitioning you smoothly. So
now you say this doesn't make any sense. You have to stop and say that, don't you?
And then it just goes on to explain the observation car that teaches you how to show and not tell, and of course, the all-important caboose, which ties it all together. So that's basically a real brief overview of what the train of thought method is.
Okay. Well, the boxcar is a lot like an outline in some ways, then, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In fact, the whole thing really is. Each boxcar contains an individual thought within the entire piece, and sometimes, and this works really well in a class where I'm teaching for a long period of time, we get, I have each student take several sheets of paper and write the general ideas that they want to contain within the piece. They write one idea on each piece of paper, and then begin to arrange and rearrange them until they seem to fit or fall into a logical progression. And that really helps the piece tremendously. And so, yes, it's sort of a visual outline that you're putting right in front of you where you can actually see it.
Okay. Well, you also mentioned the fact that you need a, what do they call it? Well, some people call it a hook to get people, yes, I want to read this.
Yes. Oh, that's huge. And what I call it in this method is the cow catcher.
The cow catcher,
Unless you're at least my age or older, you may not know what that is, but I don't think they have them anymore. But it was on the front of trains, and it would, when the train came down the track, this metal grate in front of the engine, if there were a cow or some other animal on the track, it would scoop that animal up and carry them to the next place where it stopped and dropped them there. Now, what condition the cow might be in, I can't tell you. But it gave them a chance anyway, because without it, they basically got splattered, and it could also, upset the train.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a piece of that comes along and just snatches you right up off that track and carries you along. And that's why we call it a cow catcher, because you're opening to whatever piece you're writing is your cow catcher. It is what comes along and scoops you up and says, come on, I'm taking you on a fun ride. And if you don't have that, it's very unlikely that you're going to snag your reader's attention anywhere later down the line.
Now, is there any one part of this method, any one part of this train that's more important than, that's like the most important, or are they all really, really vital?
Well, I can't say that any are unimportant, and I would say probably they're all equally important because they're separate units that make up a whole. However, if I had to isolate one thing, it would have to be the track that the train runs on. That's the opening chapter of the book, because without that, you can have the greatest looking train in the world and have all the right parts, but without a track, it's not going anywhere.
That's right.
So that's what I would say is the most important, and probably the thing that we deviate most from as writers.
Now, this is the one or two sentence main idea.
Exactly. Yes, right. Exactly.
And it could also be in another, like an analogy, it could be called the elevator pitch. If you if you stepped on
Absolutely
an elevator
true.
With the publisher of the publisher that you would most like to be published with, and he said, "What's your book about?" And you had 30 seconds.
I just came from a writer's conference and a convention, and of course, many of us went knowing that we might very well run into those elevator moments with a publisher or an agent standing there looking at us, and we've got 20 seconds at the most to convince them that they can't walk off that elevator without having a meeting with us and signing us on a contract. So we all went with our elevator pitches, and you're absolutely right. That is what basically the cowcatcher is. It's snagging their attention and convincing them in a matter of very few words that they just simply can't live without reading the rest of what you've done here. So,
have you ever had that happen to you, that exact thing?
Not often, but I won't say never. Yes, I guess probably the most amazing thing happened as a result of an accidental elevator pitch. I happened to mention once to a publisher that I knew and had worked with on some other projects, and he knew my writing, but he didn't know anything about me personally. And I happened to mention to him what a football fanatic I was, and it was a brief moment in passing when I said that. I said, some of my passions are, of course, writing, and anytime I can write, I obviously want it to be to somehow in some way express the gospel, but I said I have to confess that I have another passion, and that's football. So sure enough, not too much long later after that, he happened to get a call from Rosie Greer's agent, who said, my client wants to do a book, he needs a ghostwriter, he would like it to be a woman because it should be someone who could give it a little bit of a soft touch, someone who's an experienced writer, someone who's a strong Christian. And he said, and here's the clincher. I don't know if you know anybody like this, but somebody who loves football. And so that little tiny thing that I happened to say at that point turned out to be the hook that snagged me two book contracts with Rosie as my co-author.
Is it hard to ghostwrite? Is that difficult?
Oh, absolutely. But it's fun. I think probably what helped me the most, in addition to taking all my journalism and creative writing classes, was I took drama classes when I was in junior high and high school, and I was in Little Women, and I died so well. I was the I played the starring role in Jane Eyre. I had no desire to be on the stage as a career, but it taught me to climb inside someone else's skin and talk like them and think like them. And with ghostwriting, you really have to be able to do that, because it can't be just their thoughts in your words. You have to think and reason and speak as they do. So that was a huge help to me.
So it's different than editing, a lot different.
Oh, absolutely.
Than editing. Yeah.
Editing, I've done a lot of too. I've worked in-house at Regal Books as an editor and done a lot of freelance editing. And in that case, you've pretty much got something to work with that you're just basically strengthening. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
But with ghostwriting, it could be anything as small as here's a thought in a couple sentences, write a book about it in this person's voice, to here's a set of teaching tapes, turn that into a book. So it kind of runs the gamut, but yes, you basically become that person and write what they would write if they were doing it.
Did you get to spend a lot of time with Rosie Greer?
Yes, I did. It was quite an experience. I used to kid and tell people I was his bodyguard. He's such a big guy, but he is the gentle giant they say he is, and I'm 5'2" on a good day. So so it was interesting, but yes, he was very amenable to work with, although basically when I ghostwrite, I do that by myself. I might spend time with the person, getting to know them, how they think, how they talk, listening to their voice inflections and their speech patterns, and getting to know their heart so that I will be true to what their message would be. But then I go home by myself and write in my little cave and just send stuff to them maybe a chapter at a time or whatever, so they can approve it or disapprove it and go from there.
So do they give you notes of ideas that they might have or anything
sometimes,
like that?
Sometimes. Now, and for instance, in the case with there were two books with Rosie, as I said, and the first one was what he said was, and this was the only entire summary he gave me, I want to do a collection of stories, interviews with top Christian athletes that would encompass two things. First, their favorite sports memory. Second, some spiritual insight from them. And that was basically it. And then he checked out, and I was on my own, other than he set up the interviews, because obviously he knew these people and I didn't.
Right.
The other one was a novel called being called Shooting Star. And he said, I want to write a novel about an aging football star who befriends a young homeless kid. And that was all I had to work with. So from there, I basically wrote the book.
Oh, my gosh.
But again, from his viewpoint.
Wow.
I didn't realize that you didn't have more than that. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's not much, is it?
No, but that's fantastic.
Now, you know, what, I mean, in a way, it's, sometimes when you think ghostwritten, you think, well, it's really, you're sitting down with the person and you're just, you know, sort of putting down on paper what they're saying, but this sounds like it's very different from that. And
and you know, sometimes it is that. I shouldn't say that it never is. Once in a while, there is a person who wants to be involved in every aspect and basically gives you quite a bit of material to work from. And you're just, it's somewhere between that fine line of ghostwriting and editing, because they actually are giving you some material. I did that for a man who was a counselor and a correctional officer at San Quentin on death row for 40 years. Wow. And he had some amazing stories from having worked with Charles Manson and Sirhan and several others. And so he had sort of kept a diary. And I did have that to work with, and we worked back and forth over the phone and through the mail. But I've never really sat down with someone side by side at a computer or typewriter and said, okay, let's start working. I don't do well that way. I need to get off, like I said, in my cave by myself and just shut the world out and start working. So, again, it can run the gamut, and there are some people that I know they do really well the other way, working very, very closely, but that's not my strong point.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Kathy Macias, author of The Train of Thought Writing Method and numerous other books, some bearing her name and some not. Which leads me to a question, Kathy, is it hard at all when you really have completely written a book that it's being published under somebody else's name and perhaps selling more than it would be if it were coming out under your name just because of who they are? How does that feel?
That's a really, really strong point to mention. And, of course, it is changing. When I began doing this 20 years ago, there was a lot more actual ghost writing, meaning you're invisible. Not that much of that these days. It's much more collaborative writing. And even the books I wrote with Rosie Greer were done by Rosie Greer and Kathy Macias. My name was a lot smaller, or with Kathy Macias, either way. But very often what I have noticed through the years is some of the biggest names who are just household names everywhere, they are really so gracious that they came and it was their suggestion, saying, I want your name on the cover too. I don't feel right about it. And I really appreciated that they would do that. But apart from that, as long as I have agreed ahead of time and said, yes, this is a work for hire project, I realize I'm getting paid to do the writing and I won't have my name on the front, I'm perfectly fine with that. Although, like I said, I do less of that now than I ever did before. But it's a project-by-project decision. It's something you sit down and decide with people. And in a lot of instances, when it's someone's life story that they have walked through moment by moment, I feel almost unfair by putting my name on it, because it seems like they're the ones who lived it. I've been paid for my writing. Let them run with it. Now, I do have one coming out soon that I collaborated with a woman to help her write it, and it is her story. It's called Face of Faith, and her name is Candy Wood, but and she is going to include my name because she wanted to do that, and I appreciate that. But I can go either way with it. I'm all right with it.
Now, when it comes time to promote the book, are you involved at all, or the, you know, any book tours, any interviews?
That's another great question. You know, normally I'm not, and much of what I did in the ghostwriting days way back when, very few authors did promote or market their own books unless they were celebrities and had an existing platform. Nowadays, of course, all authors are required and expected to market their books, but it wasn't so before. We didn't have agents. We didn't have publicists. We just wrote the book and turned the manuscript in and went on to the next one and let the publisher handle the publicity. And so all that's changed now. And the new book that's coming out, the one I just mentioned, Face of Faith, I probably won't actively promote it. I'll put it on my website. I'll have it on my book table. But Candy will be doing the marketing herself. If I'm a recipient on a ghostwriter collaborative work, then I would most certainly be out there helping to promote it. But otherwise, if it's pretty much a work for hire, with or without my name, I'm not doing the marketing part.
So sometimes you get paid a flat fee, And other times you get paid. Do you get paid some upfront plus?
That's what I normally do. That's the easiest way. Now, if a publisher hires me, and very often that happens, what we normally decide, it's usually a flat rate. Then they will call and offer me a certain amount, and so then I have to stop and look at what they've got and what they're working with, where they're going, and try to guesstimate the hours that are going to be involved so I can decide if the amount they're offering is going to work out well or not. And then they normally pay me half up front and half when I'm done. But more than likely I'm going to be working with an individual. And at that point, what I have found works best is, because you never know where that's going to end up or what kind of hours are going to be involved, I normally just quote an hourly rate plus expenses, and then I say, and here's what I will give you as a ceiling rate. I will not go over this amount for the entire project, and I will more than likely come in underneath it, and I estimate high. And then the person gives me either a third or a half as a retainer, and then the rest when we're done. Sometimes if it's a long project, we will arrange to have it paid monthly as we go. And that seems to work out well for everybody.
Good. I'm curious about the mysteries that you wrote. When you write a mystery, do you know the ending before you start writing?
Well, I do know the beginning and I know the very ending, but I have no clue how I'm going to get from A to B.
Okay.
isn't that awful? I know of all people, here I am with my train of thought writing method. But when it comes to a mystery, I tend to fly by the seat of my pants. I have a real rough idea. But each chapter, as I come to it, I'm thinking, now where do I need to go next? It's so different than laying out a nonfiction book. And even though I have known people who have used the train of thought method very effectively in fiction, for myself, I tend to veer away from it, although I will come back later when I'm done with my first draft and then use it to apply it and make sure I'm on track. But I tend to start off, for instance, with Obsession, which was the first of my mystery trilogy with Brosman and Holman. I did know how I wanted it to end, and I started it off just fine, but I had no clue how I was going to work out this mystery of my main character's father having died when he was all by himself in the middle of a lake on a rowboat fishing and have it, and of course everyone assumed he had a heart attack because he had a bad heart, and I had to figure out how he was actually murdered. So when you draw on all those books about, 365 ways how to murder someone, or you call in your detective friends and you say, I really need some ideas here. So that's a little bit more of flying by the seat of my pants on those type of things, and I'm working on one right now, in fact, that will actually be, because you mentioned I had 15 books. I actually, my 18th book just released, Beyond Me. It's a nonfiction book from New Hope, and it's on my website. I have to throw that in there.
Okay.
But I'm working on a novel which will be releasing in March, and it's called My Son John, and it does deal with some legal issues. And so on that, I have a really great detective friend from my church who is going over it with a fine-tooth comb each chapter as I go. Those kind of things are invaluable input because you really, really want them to be completely believable and realistic.
Well, you in your book here, you talked about a book that you were writing, the process of writing, and Imogene is your character, main character.
Yes.
I want to know what happens to Imogene. You got me hooked.
Oh, good. And it is out. And Imogene Reborn, that is, and it can be ordered from my website also. In fact, it's in the process of being turned into a screenplay. So
really, I bet it is. That's going to be good. Yeah.
And yes, I'm really looking forward to that. I really love this story. So
is that the first?
I don't want to tell how it ends on the radio, but
no. Is that the first one? That's
excited again. So
is that the first one that's been a screenplay then?
Yes.
Oh, very exciting.
So what is Imogene Reborn about?
That one is really—it's really interesting. And now this is one that I co-authored. It wasn't a ghostwritten one, but it was a co-author. And the gentleman that was my co-author, we've actually never met face to face. His name is Dr. Cupid Poe. He lives in Nashville. He is a pastor, but he's also a psychiatrist. And he called me. He was referred to me by a writer you may know, Cece Murphy. and who does a lot of collaborative work. And Dr. Poe wanted to have me help him write a book about one of his clients, and or patients, I should say. And he told me the story of her life, just a little bit of it, and I thought, oh, no, that sounds like a lawsuit waiting to happen. But I said, let's take the nugget and turn it into a novel. And the nugget that I latched on to create the story with was that this woman was born to parents late in life. The parents were already in their mid 40s when the young lady was born. Her name wasn't Imogene, but we'll call her that. They had several sons, and they had lost a daughter many years earlier, and we'll call her Imogene 1, because what happened was the father transferred her name from Imogene, the first baby that died, to this new baby who was born Imogene, called her Imogene 2. And the mother, because the mother actually, she was very superstitious and believed she was the first daughter reincarnated. So it was a bizarre thing. And so this young girl grew up not having any identity of her own. And of course, it isn't until she comes to know the Lord and actually is born again that she begins to realize who she is in Christ. But the real twist that we added to it was that she was raised in a very racially prejudiced home where her father was even a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and then she is actually saved years later in an African American church. So it's a great story. I really enjoyed doing it.
Wow. Yeah, it is. It's going to be great. I mean, I'm anxious to read it.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kathy Macias, author of The Train of Thought Writing Method and many, many other books. Kathy, when you're working on like a ghostwriting project, do you ever feel like it's taking time away from your own writing projects?
Oh, absolutely, and I really struggle with that.
Yeah, I'll bet.
That is something I really pray about. I'm actually not doing nearly as many ghostwriting projects now. In fact, I just, the one Face of Faith, I finished up, and I don't have any on back burner at this moment. I never say never. I've learned that, and there may come a time when another story like that comes along that is just so good I can't resist it and I have to take it. But I'm really focusing a lot more on my own books now. However, I do have to tell you that many years ago, when I was a brand new Christian at the age of 26, and I had wanted to write long before that, I was begging God to let me write Christian books. I thought, this is what I've been called to do. And nothing worked out. I mean, it just, every door slammed in my face. Of course, I was pretty young then, didn't realize that. I thought I was mature, but I wasn't. But when I really, it was probably the first time I ever heard, and obviously not audibly, but in my heart knew that God was speaking to me. And he said, you'll be ready to write books for me when you're ready to write books without your name on them. And I had no clue what that meant. But I put it all in the back burner and went on with other things. And it was, more than 10 years later when I was working in-house at Regal Books as an editor on some adult curriculum that the publisher came to me and asked me if I'd like to do a freelance project. And he said, I need you to actually ghostwrite a book. And he said, you'll be writing the book, but it won't have your name on it. Just like, wow. The green light just went on, and I knew that God was speaking to my heart about doing that. Now, I've had people come to me and say it isn't honest to ghostwrite because you're writing something and letting somebody else take credit, but I don't really have a problem with that as long as that's all decided up front. And and I do know that in my own case that's what God had called me to do. And so I do still do it on occasion, but there came a point when I really realized that God was saying it was okay to move ahead and begin to do my own books too. So yes, if I'm in the middle of something and I really want to stay on my own books and I end up spending time on a ghostwriting project, it's difficult to stay focused because I don't always have the same passion that I would for my own books. But I'm also a very disciplined person, and so once I've made a commitment to do it, I'm going to push through and finish it no matter what.
Now, the train of thought writing method does seem like a fairly disciplined method of writing, too.
It is. Now, it truly is. And in all honesty, as you become a seasoned writer and have used that system or actually any system for any length of time, you do tend to deviate a little bit and maybe not walk the line quite so strictly. But by that time, it's become pretty ingrained in you, and you catch yourself when you're getting off the focus or off the track. So, and as I said, sometimes I will, especially in fiction, I'll just go ahead and write my first draft and then go back and look and see if I've really followed the method as I should and kept it in correct order. But for a beginning writer, I think it's important. I really do, to just really learn this and to practice it until it does become second nature before you begin to deviate on your own, because there's nothing worse than an editor realizing that there's a nugget of a good idea in a piece, but it's just too hard to follow because it's too disjointed. Yeah.
Now, when you start to develop characters and so forth and their situations, how do you avoid boredom in the writing?
Oh, that's so important. You know, this is why I added an entire chapter to the train of thought method, and that's the observation card. That was not in the method when I first learned it. But this is where I speak. The whole chapter is devoted toward helping people not only develop good descriptiveness in their writing, but 3D characters, people that aren't flat, people that are believable, and that the reader will care about, because your story needs to unfold through the readers, through the characters, I'm sorry, so that they're so realistic that the readers are caught up in their lives and it matters to them what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that came home to me on when I was actually writing the novel Shooting Star with Rosie, and my editor, who was absolutely a tremendous fiction editor, and I had only done one novel prior to that, and she called me one day and she says, you know, you've got a great story here. It's really fairly well written, but I got to tell you, your main character, honestly, I don't care if she dies.
Oh, no.
But that's when I realized she was not a three-dimensional person.
Mm-hmm.
I had told all the good things about her, you know, what she looked like, and everything was surface. I hadn't really developed her enough underneath. There weren't enough believable characteristics about her to make the reader relate to her. So that's when I began to learn what was really important in developing believable characters, and that's what keeps your book from being boring.
And you say that using action words to show rather than telling what the characters are doing, you show the reader what they're doing.
Absolutely. There's nothing worse than having someone tell you what's going on. It's a little bit like going to a speech and having someone stand up in front of the room and read from their notes.
Mm.
I've always thought, you know, can there be anything more boring? Why not just run off the notes, run off copies, pass them out, and let people read it themselves? it's no fun, you know. So we want a little life breathed into it, and that's how it happens with writing. When you begin to show, when you learn about strong verbs instead of trying to pad your manuscript with adverbs, and you use strong nouns instead of overusing adjectives. That's all part of the observation car teaching as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kathy, you mentioned speakers, which you also do a lot of public speaking.
Yes, I do, and actually I had such a wonderful experience. Just last week I was in Orlando for the International Christian Retail Services Convention, and also just prior to that was the Advanced Writers and Speakers Association Conference, which is a group of approximately 250 Christian women who are all professional writers and speakers. And at our Golden Scrolls Award Banquet on Sunday while we were there, the founder of our group began to read all the accomplishments of the woman who had been chosen as the member of the year, and she's reading all these things off about her, and I'm thinking, wow, we have a lot in common. The more she said, the more I thought, I've got to meet this woman. I can't believe how much we have in common. And my husband was looking at me like, you get it? But I didn't. And so she called my name, and then I realized I had received that award. I was really overwhelmed.
Oh.
And this is really overwhelming, and it has to be a miracle, a God thing, because when I became a Christian at the age of 26, I told God I would do anything for him. I'd go anywhere, do anything he wanted, so long as it did not include public speaking.
Yeah.
Boy, did he have a sense of humor. So he definitely moved me out of my comfort zone, and as I began to sell books, I found out, what a shock, that people now expected me to go out and speak about them. So it took me a while, and it really stretched me, as my new book is called Beyond Me, it stretched me beyond anything I could do in my own strength or ability. It was really a beyond me a time of my life where I had to learn about not just talking about depending on God, but really doing it. And much of that I've talked about in the new book. Just learning that I really can do public speaking only because God called me and gifted me to do it, but in the natural, I wanted nothing to do with it. So it's kind of, I'm glad you asked me that. It's something that I find so many new writers do have a similar problem. They say that the number one fear is public speaking. So I know I'm not alone in that.
But you've gone beyond just speaking about your books, too.
You actually write
speeches and presentations as a keynote speaker and a conference speaker and so forth.
Yes, I've ended up actually getting called on to do several of those things. In fact, one time, it's been 2 or 3 years ago, I was going just to teach a class. In fact, it was on the Train of Thought Writing Method at the Orange County Christian Writers Conference, not far from me. I go there every year and I teach, and just a day or two before, the conference organizers contacted me and said, "We have a problem. Our keynote speaker, Dan Benson, who's an editor at one of the publishing houses back east, slipped on the ice and he can't come, and you're the keynote speaker."
Next in line.
So it was one of those things where you really don't even have time to write something out and rehearse it. But one of the things I learned over the years, and particularly when I worked with Rosie, who did a lot, I don't know if he still does, but did a lot of public speaking at the time, he said, "Don't worry so much about writing your speech out. Just jot down a couple of notes and then talk from your heart." Mm. And I have learned over the years that really works best. I tend to, if I write things out, write out speeches or keynotes, then I begin to sound rehearsed and sort of wooden. Whereas if I just jot down a couple of key points and then go from there, sometimes I forget to even look at them, and just start and actually trust God to help me know what to say, and off I go, and then I enjoy it. Then I'm not so nervous that, oh my goodness, what if I forget something? So if I had to encourage any writer or anybody who's struggling with the idea of, gee, what if this includes some public speaking, I don't want to do that, I think once you get past the first few times, you'll find out that it's really not that bad, and you might actually enjoy it.
Well, there was a time, too, wasn't it, when a former teacher asked you to speak to his class? And you were really...
Yes, I do remember that. That was, I was actually living in the hometown where I grew up, and so the man who had been not only my English teacher, but my creative writing teacher in high school, and of course whom I had great respect and admiration for and had encouraged me very much in my writing, he asked me if I would come and speak to the class, and I thought, I don't want to do that, but I didn't see how I could turn him down. And this was before I was doing any public speaking, so it was quite an experience. I went there just dreading it, and you'd think I was addressing Congress the way I felt about it. It was, 25 or 30 high school students, and it actually turned out to be a good experience, but it was nerve-wracking at the time.
Well, then that one student asked you a question, and then you were off, right? You went, you're off on the train then.
Exactly. When I sat there trying to come up with stuff myself, I was saying things, but it just didn't sound natural. And then one student did ask me a question, which I can't remember what it was, but at the time, I just answered it normally as if we were having a conversation, and from then on, the whole thing just sort of took on a life of its own, and it flowed, and it ended up being a really positive experience.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, I know that you've selected a couple of pieces from your book to read to our audience, and we better get to at least the first one of those now, or we'll run out of time.
We'll run out of time to do it, won't we? Okay.
So this is Kathy.
Yes, I have
Kathy Macias.
I've divided it up into two parts so that if you need to take a moment in between, you can do that. What I'm going to do is just read the introduction first, and then go on to just the first part of chapter one, because I think it really gives people the overall feel for the tone of the book and where it's going.
Great.
So, should I go ahead?
Yes, this is Kathy Macias reading from the Train of Thought Writing Method.
Okay, thank you. As the author of numerous books and countless articles and short stories, I am constantly asked the same question: where do you get your ideas? For someone with as active an imagination as mine, ideas are not the problem. I have more ideas than time to utilize them. The real question is, how do you effectively take those ideas and convert them to saleable manuscripts? And that's what this book is all about. It is said that writing is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. I absolutely agree, and I'm sure most successful writers would echo my sentiments. Inspiration, or coming up with ideas, is the easy part. But I contend that writing itself is not an easy profession. Though I've heard it argued that writing is indeed easy, so long as you're willing to sit down at the computer and open a vein. There's a lot of truth in that statement of absolute commitment, as you will see as we work our way through this book. Over the years, I've spoken with and taught beginning writers from all around the world, in all areas of settings. I've helped them review, edit, and rewrite their work, and I've found one common thread among those would-be writers who eventually become published authors. They are willing to devote themselves to the not-so-fun, open-the-vein part of writing, the 90% perspiration. Most all writers enter the industry with some serious misconceptions. I know I imagined myself spending at least as much time on book signing tours as sitting in front of the computer trying to get my thoughts on paper. But here it is, more than 20 years later, and I'm still spending a minimum of 90% of my professional time sitting in front of the computer, writing and rewriting and rewriting again. Because when it comes down to it, that's what successful writing is really all about, the rewriting. I once heard someone say that good books are not written, they are rewritten. How true that is. And how difficult and discouraging it can be at times. But through the years, I've found what I consider to be the simplest and most practical writing method available, the train of thought method, though it may be known by other names as well. I wish I could tell you that this wonderful writing method originated with me, or at least that I knew where it actually did originate, but it didn't, and I don't, though I diligently tried to trace it back to its origin. I do know that others, including the late Georgiana Walker, have taught the method at writers' conferences for years. I also know that author Omer Henry mentioned it in a chapter of his book titled Writing and Selling Magazine Articles, first published by the Writer Incorporated in 1962. Beyond that, I've been unable to locate any information or printed material on the subject. And so I've decided to put it in writing myself. This is not a book about proper grammar or punctuation or how best to choose the voice or set the scene for your great American novel. There are already countless books covering those subjects, if that's what you're looking for. But if you want to know how best to take your thoughts and dreams and put them into a clear, compelling, readable manuscript, then this is the book for you. Having personally seen the train of thought writing method help so many new writers learn to organize, write, and polish their ideas into successful manuscripts, I offer this book to those who would do the same. May it direct and encourage you as you enter into the 90% perspiration phase of your writing career, the serious phase through which true writers are formed. I go on to chapter one?
Yes, please do.
Okay, it's called Laying the Track. Have you ever made the mistake of asking an 8-year-old what a movie was about? I have, and the results were brutal. Nearly an hour later, as he finally wrapped up his nonstop blow-by-blow report with, and that's what it was about, my eyes were glazed over and I was bordering on comatose. All I could think of was, I just asked what time it was. I didn't want to know how to make the clock. Honestly, a simple, it was a story about a dog named Snickers would have sufficed. 8-year-olds, however, have not yet learned to focus. Their attention span is still somewhat akin to that of a housefly, so I knew it was pointless to try to explain to him that I simply wanted a one-line synopsis of the movie. Better to cut my losses and make a run for it before he started telling me about the sequel. But are adults that much different? To be more specific, are writers that much different? We should be. In fact, we must be if we are to be effective communicators, but are we? One of the most frequent problems I see among new writers is a desire to eat the entire elephant. I'm sure you've heard the saying that the only way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time, and that's a great way to approach writing. For instance, if you want to write a story about your family vacation to the Redwoods, you need to stick to what actually happened on that trip. You should, of course, include enough information about your family, the scenery, the weather, and the magnificent trees to bring your story to life. But you don't have to write an encyclopedia on trees in general. Or if you're thinking of writing about a particular spiritual experience you once had, you don't want to attempt to write an apologetic on the entire Bible. In other words, successful writing is about finding and keeping your focus, unlike the 8-year-old with the limited attention span who rambled on and on about the movie because he wasn't able to formulate and express one clear thought. In essence, he was trying to eat the entire elephant in one big bite. I've seen a lot of writers attempt to attempt the same thing, and it simply does not work. Now, because you're reading this book, I assume you're a writer, a beginning writer and or an as-yet unpublished writer possibly, but a writer nonetheless. Therefore, I will also assume that you have at least one great idea burning in your chest, crying to get out and make its way into a book or magazine. If I were to ask you, as I wanted to ask that 8-year-old, for a one-line synopsis of your masterpiece, would you be able to give it to me? If not, then I have to ask you another question. Do you really know what your idea is about? Think about it for a moment. If you can't summarize your would-be manuscript, or maybe one you've already written, in one line, that tells me you aren't really clear on the theme or purpose of the piece. How then can you expect your readers to figure it out? After all, our readers are the key to the success of anything we write. My journalism professor at USC once told me, our job as writers is not so much to express ourselves as it is to effectively communicate an idea to our readers. If someone reads one of my books and comes away scratching his head and mumbling, I wonder what that was all about, he's certainly not going to read my next book or recommend my work to anyone else. And that, in the extremely competitive publishing world, can be fatal to any writing career. It's not that we don't want to make our readers think. All writers have some sort of underlying message that we want readers to chew on for a while, hopefully even after they've finished reading our work. But we also want them to be clear on what the message is. The only way to assure that happening is first to be sure that we ourselves are clear on what we are trying to say.
Thank you, Kathy. That was Kathy Macias reading from the Train of Thought Writing Method. Now, Kathy, you and I had discussed a little earlier one of the writing sort of methods that we've talked about in our show before is the mind mapping or clustering, which is more of a kind of free form where you take a piece of paper and jot down everything that comes, just anything that comes to mind about your subject, and then draw circles and lines between things that are related and so forth. Now, how would that method fit in with the train of thought method?
I think that's really excellent, and sometimes I know myself, I tend to do that. I guess I call it brainstorming. And a lot of times when you're getting ready to write a piece, all these different ideas will begin to pop up in your mind, and you need to get them down like that and begin to connect them and begin to make some sense out of them. And really those thoughts that you're writing down at that point are probably going to end up being some of your or most of your boxcars that you will later develop into the entire piece. As I told you earlier, I tend to sometimes, now that I've been doing this for a while, deviate a little bit from the initial train of thought method and just kind of try to get something on paper. And I had a writing mentor at one time, and this is a terrible term to use, but he called it your vomit chapter.
Oh.
Isn't that terrible? You basically open your mouth and throw out whatever there is onto the paper and then go back and clean it up later. And I think that kind of combines both of these ideas. You take some of these ideas that are popping up in your mind, you throw them onto the paper, and you start trying to connect them and see how they work. And that's kind of the vomit stage of what you're doing. Then you take the train of thought method and begin to start cleaning it up and putting it in order. And actually, it's a great combination to make it work and turn it into a really, really good and strong manuscript.
We've also, you've had a lot of experience publishing your work, it sounds like, in many different venues. How did you find your first publisher, and how many different publishers have you used, and was it hard getting published? I mean, that seems to be the big obstacle for a lot of beginning writers.
Yes, it really is. And my first publisher, it worked out really well. I had honestly not even considered writing books. I was thinking more in terms, I was publishing magazine articles and newspaper articles and writing a newspaper column. And as I said, I had started doing some editing at Regal Books in their curriculum department, and actually came in at entry-level position, part-time, you know, no benefits, low pay. But I really loved it. It was a foot in the door. And that was huge. And so when one of the other editors there at Regal and I started talking, and it was an excuse to go out every day and have a piece of pie at our favorite restaurant, we started talking about, gee, maybe we should do a book. And between us, we brainstormed until we came. We kind of did our you know, mind mapping and clustering until we came up with an idea for a women's devotional. Now, this was in the late 80s, prior to everybody doing the compilation books, we kind of launched that big idea. We did a women's devotional called A Moment a Day, and it actually turned out to be a bestseller for Regal Books. And so because we worked there, we went to the publisher who we knew and said, here's our idea, what do you think? And he gave us a whopping $500 advance and said, go for it. And so it was maybe what some people would think of as a small beginning, but then it didn't hurt that Dr. Dobson liked it and picked up I don't know how many copies and ran it on his radio program and his magazine every day for the month of May as a Mother's Day premium. So that's I thought at that time that marketing was pretty simple. I didn't realize he wasn't going to do that with my other books. So actually, I really got my foot in the door with the first book because I was working there. And it was also, as I said earlier, in the days before agents and all of that, and you kind of developed working relationships with people, and I would call the publisher and say, here's my idea, what do you think? And sometimes before the day was over, he'd say, oh, you know, stop by, sign the contract, and I'll have a check for you so you can get going. So it was a lot more informal in those days. It began to change as my second, third, fourth book began to be released, and I ended up branching out to different publishers. And I was actually doing fairly well. I think I published with maybe six or seven different CBA publishers, and a couple of them being some really big ones. But then I think I was asleep at the wheel. I didn't realize that it had changed. I was still operating under the idea that Christian publishers didn't, or Christian authors didn't need agents or publicists, or they didn't need to market their books. And I was wondering why suddenly I was having a lot of trouble getting contracts with all the experience I had, and no one said it wasn't because they were well written and they were great ideas, but they were getting turned down and I wasn't getting enough feedback on why. And a few years ago I was actually at they still called it a CBA convention then, and an editor who I knew well and was having breakfast with did me a great favor and said to me, Kathy, if you want to stay competitive in this business, you got to start marketing. So I began to learn that, and I learned that when I turn in a book proposal now, the first, 25% anyway, of the proposal is a marketing plan, and they know I'm serious about helping them, partnering with them to market my books. So that is probably the key in such a competitive market. Wow. You can have the greatest idea in the world, and you can be the most polished train of thought or any other kind of writer there is, but if a publisher looks at it and says, okay, nobody knows who this author is, so we don't have that to go on, and how do we know this thing is going to sell? They want to see that you are seriously going to get out there and do some marketing with them, partner with them in that. And that is probably the greatest tip I can give new authors who want to sell their proposals to publishers.
What are some of the ways that you do market your books?
Well, I have learned the internet inside out. I don't really like the marketing end of it, but I did take seriously what that editor said to me. So I got involved in all sorts of online groups and started blogging and started networking. That's probably the greatest thing you can do. And one of the things I've learned that's real effective, and it's not costly at all, in fact, sometimes you actually make a few dollars off of it, is you take the main topic of your newest book and you tweak it to all sorts of online e-zines and offer them free articles. Mm-hmm. Because my newest book, Beyond Me, and the subtitle is Living a You First Life in a Me First World, is so easily tweaked to lots of Christian living topics. I've written How to Prepare Your Grad for Beyond Me Living and posted that one on Crosswalk. I did one on how to take your writing to a Beyond Me level for some writer's e-zines. I did one for Christian women's ministry leaders, you know, how to train your women's women leadership to minister beyond me. And, you know, those are all kinds of things that can be done. And I just met with an editor recently who said, I'd love a whole string of Beyond Me articles from you. You can do one on beyond having a Beyond Me marriage, preparing your family for Beyond Me Christmas, that sort of thing.
Wow.
I think you just learn to get real creative, and you don't have to rewrite the entire thing each time. You tweak it to the particular topic.
Now, if people want to learn more about you or take a look at the books you've written, your website is
www.kathi, and it's K-A-T-H-I, macias.com, kathymacias.com.
And are your books also available on Amazon?
Amazon, CBD. Of course, Train of Thought is not available on CBD, but yes, it is available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. But mostly, and many of them are available in bookstores. Beyond Me is.
And our local bookstores can
order
them.
But all of them are on my website, yes.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Kathy. We certainly enjoyed
this. Oh, thank you, Monica. I enjoyed it immensely.
It was really great, and I really enjoyed the book. I mean, when I saw it was a workbook, I thought, oh, this is good. This is something different. And I think people, I highly recommend for people starting to write.
So check out.
Thank you.
We check out www.kathymacias, K-A-T-H-I-M-A-C-I-S, M-A-C-I-A-S.com.
That's it. Thank you.
And goodbye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. And we are about out of time.
Yeah.
Of course,
yeah.
stay tuned for James Moore with Planet Erstwhile and his always eclectic music and guests and wonderful things if you're listening Friday afternoon. We're going to be at Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat tonight with all 16 of our family members that will be in town. So we're going to be taking up quite
a
bit. Of the theater.
Yeah. We're going to fill
so
up the theater.
Fun. We're going to fill up the theater. And we will close today with a quote from Mom.
Oh, I got a great one. You remember who Henry Kissinger was, of course.
Yes.
And he said, the nice thing about being a celebrity is that when you bore people, they think it's their fault.
Thanks for listening to Writers' Voices, and we'll see you next week.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.